Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Female participation in organized sports is a relatively new concept, spurred largely by the federal Title IX law that forced schools accepting federal funds to create an even playing field for women. But girls and women have been playing sports for generations, although often in the background, in the shadows, so to speak, of their male counterparts. That has been especially so for what are considered male-dominated sports, from basketball to football, wrestling, and ice hockey. We're talking about life for women and girls in male-dominated sports today. Howard Shapiro is co-author of the recently published graphic novel, Kate's Really Good at Hockey. It's the story of a girl from Tennessee who at first struggles with the expectations of elite junior hockey. Howard Shapiro joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. How are you today?
Very well, thanks. The subplot of the story, I guess, or the secret, is that Kate's grandmother, with whom she stays while attending a summer camp for elite female players, has a secret. Her grandmother was a hockey star herself as a girl and a young woman in Canada. What was the idea behind making that part of this story?
Well, you know, we were kind of looking for a hook, you know, and you know, the story is, you know, part of it is, as you mentioned, I mean, you know, Kate goes from Tennessee to this camp in Denver and, you know, is told it by her mother, kind of just told, not asked, but told she's going to be staying with her grandmother, who she feels she has nothing in common with. And, you know, her grandmother basically seems distant to her, et cetera. And, you know, they're able actually to bond through the playing hockey. And so we were kind of looking for that kind of twist where it turns out that her grandmother was this major, you know, pioneer in playing hockey, again, as you mentioned, in Canada. And it brings them closer. And it's sort of how my dad and I, you know, it's actually the story itself is actually based on, it's a retcon of a self-published book that I did called Hockey Days, which is about my dad, myself, and how we bonded through hockey. And so that's how Kate ends up bonding and realizing her grandmother's got this whole other life. It's just, it was just a kind of a story hook that we put in there.
Well, you know, the fact is that girls lack a plethora, I should say, of role models when it comes to these male-dominated sports.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. And, I mean, there are, you know, there's actually two professional women's leagues now in hockey. There's, of course, the WNBA. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, that's one of the things, especially as a young kid, you really, you almost, you know, you kind of need that. Role models maybe not the right word, but, you know, somebody who, you know, I mean, I'll give you an example. When I was growing up, the 1976 Olympics, I believe, there was a boxer named Mike Rossman, who was a Jewish boxer. And I just remember, and I'll remember it all my life, because I was just, I thought, wow, there's a Jewish boxer. And it gave, not that I went into boxing, but you kind of just need those, to see those kind of, you know, people.
That you athletes, can relate to.
Yeah, exactly. When you think, well, they did, man, maybe I could do it. Or at least it gives you that idea, you know, puts it in your mind.
Most girls don't play on all-girl teams. There just aren't enough of them. You guys decided, you and your co-author decided to make this an all-girl competition, an all-girl camp. What went into that?
Well, I think it's part of it is the game is growing not only nationwide, but worldwide. And, you know, we actually, you know, we wanted to be as diverse as possible. We have our best friend in the camp is from Ecuador. And somebody, you know, might be thinking, you know, listening, like, oh, there's hockey in Ecuador. And they actually do. They, in my research, I found that they have a very, you know, strong hockey community there. India, it's growing by leaps and bounds. You know, it's growing worldwide. And I think it's getting to the point, I mean, there's, you know, the U.S. Women's Olympic team winning the gold in mm-hmm. 2018, you know, I think that was definitely a catalyst. And so I think it will continue to grow. Hockey in and of itself, the sport, boys and girls, is growing. And I think, again, that will take off, especially after 2022 Olympics in China. And actually in China, the state, or the I shouldn't say the state, the government has ordered 300 rinks to be built all throughout the country. So, you know, things like that, I think the game is growing, and we really just want to keep it focused on the girls playing.
How did you conceive the coaching-player relationship with the girls? Did you just pattern it after what you're familiar with the male teams you've been on, or how did that work?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. The coach, we really wanted her to be, you know, kind of the tough as nails coach, and she's actually based on a coach that I had in high school, who was really, really tough. really didn't have much of a personality, and but you know, we kind of what we wanted to do is have her, you know, have that kind of very tough facade and everything, but still be, you know, show that she's, you know, a caring and a person, and really that, you know, the thing is with Kate is that she, the character is that she, everything's kind of fell her way, and that's sort of based academically on my son, one of my sons, and he never really faced any adversity until, you know, much later in high school. And so I wanted to kind of bring that out as well, that somebody kind of gets everything going their way, and then what happens when you actually have to face a lot of adversity, which she does with the coach in the story. And you know, we based it kind of on my high school coach. But I think, you know, hockey coaches, you know, they come in kind of two forms. They're, you know, kind of the very players, you know, friendly coach, you know, kind of thing, and which I also had earlier when I was younger, and then the tough as nails coach who just doesn't, you know, doesn't give an inch. But I mean, we wanted to make sure that at least we pointed out that, you know, she had Kate's best interest in mind. Kate didn't think it that way, but in the end, she realizes that she wanted her to grow, and that was part of her teaching or coaching modus operandi to help her grow as a person and as a hockey player.
Why did you decide to write this story?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, it was a retcon of a self-published book that I did, and it was really special to me. It was, you know, something that I really loved, and it's kind of faded. You know, it came out in 2007, so it kind of faded away, and I was looking to... so this is the fifth hockey book I've done also. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of looking for another angle. I kind of, you know, have run as much as I can dry, you know, through hockey. but I thought that this would be a really good angle to use, and hopefully we can make a new series out of it.
You have a co-author, Christina Frey?
Correct, yes.
Why? I mean, could you not write from that female point of view, or what happened there?
Exactly. Yeah, you hit the nail right on the head. You know, I think we had a good, we had a really, really good working writing relationship, because, you know, I could bring the hockey stuff, you know, the knowledge, you know, the from playing and kind of the inner workings and the plays and things like that. And she's not a hockey fan. She's actually more of a baseball fan. And she has a 13-year-old daughter, so she was really able to bring that. And it just felt wrong for me to try and write, you know, a mother-daughter-grandmother story. It just, when I did the synopsis, or the, not the synopsis, but the draft, it just, it just felt flat. And so I asked her if she'd want to be involved. And as I said, it worked out. It couldn't have worked out better.
It's interesting. It isn't until I get to the very end that I see that she's not from a one-parent family, that Kate has two parents.
Right. Yeah, we wanted to keep. Yeah, we wanted to keep all men. For the most part, there's one of her friends in school. There's a couple boys that are kind of hanging around her friend group. But yeah, we just wanted to kind of keep it focused on the three characters and not bring another element in, which is she does. She has a younger brother and and her dad as well.
And I'm glad you brought up that this book starts where she's coming back after summer vacation, back to school, her gang gets together, and you're right, it's a mixed group, it's diverse, and there are boys, and they're listening to her tell this story.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's kind of the original idea when I did the draft was that she was going to give what I did on my summer vacation speech, and then, you know, then kids would be kind of piling into the class as it went on, and we kind of abandoned that and decided to go with the friend group, and I think that worked out. That was a really good decision.
You've written another book about hockey, as you mentioned. You've written several, The Hockey Saint. It's about the friendship between an orphaned collegiate hockey player and a pro. Are there any parallels with Kate's really good at hockey?
Not really. No, it's kind of an original story. You know, again, other than, you know, it was based on a previous book, and yeah, there's really none. Although we did work in the book you mentioned, Hockey Saint, the hockey player, his name Jeremiah Jacobson, and I thought it was kind of a neat little Easter egg to put him into the Kate world, and so hopefully we'll be able to use that with a future book. But other than that, yeah, they're completely separate.
I was going to look him up, but he's a piece of fiction, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought I have not heard of this guy, but I didn't have time to look him up.
He's actually based on kind of the anti. I'm in Pittsburgh, so he's the anti Sidney Crosby, which means you know, he's kind
of. He doesn't cry every time he gets hit down. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, or swear a lot. No, he yeah, he kind of disdains the whole idea of being a role model that kind of with the media and everything. He kind of just he's one of those athletes that just wants to play the game and that kind of thing. So but again, fictional character completely.
You know, and then the point of view of Kate's grandmother, who was a phenom in her day. She's now about 70 years old. She's being treated for breast cancer. Another secret that Kate learns while she's visiting her, but she's reluctant, and it is kind of shocking that Kate didn't know, given how much Kate loves hockey, that no one ever told her grandmother was a star. But her grandmother's kind of reluctant to put it out there. She didn't have the same kind of support from society that Kate takes for granted, kind of.
Yeah, you know, and you really hit on something, because that was that's one of the things that, you know, we try to bring out as much as we could in the writing, but it really kind of depended on the illustrator to, you know, Kate is just completely dumbfounded in 2018 or 19 that, you know, back in the old days in the 50s that there weren't girls' teams, that her grandmother wasn't allowed to play. I mean, because she's grown up in this world where, you know, she's had complete access and complete freedom to play. So she's just completely blown away by that idea. And the reason, you know, because the grandmother quit, she explains and to Kate, and it makes sense to Kate, but she still just can't kind of wrap her head around the idea that, you know, she could not play. She was not allowed to play. And we really wanted to bring that up because I think, you know, especially these days we get this whole idea of, you know, this, you know, the good old days and kind of thing. And yeah, there were certain good things, but there were also certain bad things. And, just that kind of idea of, this happened in a lifetime and in her grandmother's lifetime. So we really wanted to point that out. And, that's actually my favorite scene in the whole book, where they just sit there and talk. And it's a real cute scene. The illustrator did a wonderful job with it.
Yeah, it is. It does convey a lot of that connection being made. And then the idea that Kate wanted her grandmother to speak to her team or her fellow campers at this elite hockey camp in Denver to come out and show them and play with them a little bit, and didn't think, well, why would anyone care? I mean, times have changed. I mean, if it had been one of the stars from the 2018 Olympic team, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, that was also kind of a fun scene to write for us, because we wanted her to, you know, her grandmother to kind of take a curtain call that she, you know, Kate felt that she deserved, and that was a lot of fun to do. And then and one of the other themes that we really wanted to bring out is that, you know, for any of the kids reading it, who, again, it's aimed at 8 to 12 year olds, to really have that admiration and respect and want to talk to your, you know, grandparents and parents. And I know my kids are both 19 now, but, you know, they never really had that kind of, like, well, tell me about, you know, what you did, mm-hmm. you know, kind of thing. And so we really wanted to, you know, bring that out, and hopefully kids will hopefully talk more to their grandparents.
You grew up playing hockey?
Yeah. I grew up here in Pittsburgh.
Did you ever play with a girl?
No, we never. I was playing street hockey. It was just us, the boys in the neighborhood. And when I was in high school, it was just a boys' team. Although I think there were a couple girls that played. There was a girl who played goal, and there was a girl that was. They were both on the same team. It was a Catholic school team, and they both played. So, which was kind of unheard of then. It's like, wow, there's two girls out there, you know, kind of thing. So,
well,
was,
what did the boys say? What was it like?
Well, I mean, that's the kind of thing, you know, if somebody got hit, you know, if the girl who played defense hit one of our guys, they're, you know, oh, the girl hit you know, that kind of thing. They definitely get
razzed a little bit
if they
more.
Got knocked down. Yeah, I mean, they get razzed a lot. I mean, that was just that era, you know. It's not that it's right. That's what happened. And, you know, oh, you can't, and the girl made a good stop, the goaltender. Oh, you know, you can't get the puck past the girl, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
I mean, that's. You know, that was that era. And, you know, I mean, if you go to a women's game now, there's a heck of a lot of really good players, and they can, you know, definitely can be. I mean, you saw Kendall Coyne, who actually wrote one of our back cover quotes. You know, she finished 7th in the NHL skills competition, and it was a wonderful moment. I actually had goosebumps when I was watching, because I didn't know it was going to happen. And she was amazing, absolutely amazing.
Right. Well, Howard Shapiro, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Anne.
Howard Shapiro is co-author of the recently published graphic novel, Kate's Really Good at Hockey. We are going to continue our conversation. We're going to talk with a psychologist about the psychology of being a female in a primarily male sport coming up. So stay with us. And we're also going to meet a local girl hockey player from Thomas Worthington High School, plays on her high school hockey team, and talk to her about what that's like. So if you have any questions or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Women are gaining traction in competitive team sports, but female teams still tend to attract less attention, and the athletes typically earn less money. We wanted to talk about the dynamics on and off the field for female athletes and how they compare and contrast to their male counterparts. Joan Steidinger is a sports psychologist and author of the 2014 book, Sisterhood in Sports, How Female Athletes Collaborate and Compete. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Joan Steidinger.
I'm glad to be here.
How does the culture of competitive sports welcome or not girls?
Well, I think it's welcoming more and more. And I think it's welcoming more and more to girls in a variety of sports, including the non-traditional girl sports. For instance, in lacrosse, girls lacrosse is now the fastest growing sport for youth and girls in the United States, more than any boys sport. So you also see in marathons, because I'm a lifelong runner, you see a lot more women now in marathons than you do men. And it's almost, you know, kind of lopsided sometimes.
Is it... What was the tipping point, do you think?
Well, I think Title IX, best thing Title IX did was encourage, allow, and support girls' participation in sports. The most difficult thing it did was to not allow women in leadership. And the pay inequality is huge. And also in the media, we are only covered, women's sports are only covered 4% of the time, whereas in a country like New Zealand, it's 10% of the time. So the media isn't helping us, but we have sports like the WNBA where they're doing things to rectify it themselves to gain more followers. And they did that the past year or two by talking about social justice causes, not only ones relevant to the sport and to women, but to other ones. And in that year, they increased their viewership to 35% between ESPN and the NBA channel, and their gear, their merchandising sales increased to 66%.
Why do you think that is?
I think that they're really reaching out. Their personalities in the WNBA are stepping up and participating and talking out like personalities in men's sports. Breanna Stewart, who is a top player for Seattle Storm, did all kinds of things outside of basketball. First of all, she flew to L.A. for the protest for immigration. She also came out in her profile as that she had been sexually abused as a child herself. Hmm. So they're being more open. People are seeing them as more human And then on top of that, they're incredible athletes.
Well, the subtitle of your book is How Female Athletes Collaborate and Compete. Is it much different than how male athletes do that?
Yes, it is. It's like, let me give you just a really stark example. An old track and field coach that I used to work with, his team, he told me, having worked both with girls and boys teams, or it was community college teams, that what girls do is they want to get in a circle and talk about things more kind of together. And he said, and the boys climb a ladder and try to kick the last guy off. So girls, one of the essential things, and I talk about my theory of collaborative competition for women, is that girls, the part of having fun is even more important for girls than for boys. The part of being able to talk a little before events or even before training is essential to girls, where the boys go on task and are ready to go into training without any, that preliminary little social element in it.
And, well, why is that? Is it just the way we're socialized or what?
Well, part of it is psychology and socialization. But there is one of the things that's still debated is there still is a slight difference in the brains between men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain aspects in women's brains that draw them more to, say, multitask, draw them more to relationships. There's been a lot of research about talking about their sport and talking about it not just technically but also in a more casual way.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about relationships. Girls like to talk about relationships. And they were saying that girls talked more than boys, or women talk more than men. But what they really found, all the researchers can agree with, is that they talked more about relationships. Women talk more about relationships.
Can you give me an example and put it into the context of competitive sports when you say they talk more about relationships? Like what? I've never been on a team before. Well, I was, but... I was the shortest person to ever play high school volleyball, but very pre-Title IX. But put it in context. What does that mean to talk about relationships in that way?
They're talking about each other and their primary relationships. They're talking is more in a context. I'll give you an example. My husband was a bike racer, for example,
mm-hmm.
and he had it was girls and women in the race, too. And he had a flat tire. He had a bunch of mechanicals. So he ended up back by the women, and he wasn't supposed to ride with the women, and according to the race rules.
Mm-hmm.
And these girls, he could hear them chatting, he said, like a quarter of a mile away. Whereas when you're with men in a pack like that, none of that is going on.
Mm.
There's dead silence. And so... he's, you know, just riding in front of them because he doesn't want to get behind them. And the lead girl comes up to him and says, "We've decided you can ride with us."
So they'd been not only talking, but talking about him.
Yeah, yeah. So he dropped back and rode with the girls. And he couldn't say they couldn't believe how much they were talking.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm wondering what that means to a girl who's on a predominantly male team then. We're going to be talking to a high school hockey player who is the only female on her high school hockey team. I'm wondering what it's like for her or them.
Well, what happens is I did a lot of cycling, pacelining with a bunch of men who are racers.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is you are quiet when they're quiet, or at least for me. We'll see what her experience is. you're quiet when they're quiet, and then if they're talking about something, that gives you permission to talk some. But they're very focused on their writing and doing it well and going fast as they can. And whereas girls would be doing that, but they might be talking to each other, where the men are dead silent. So I think a girl on a men's team has to adapt. I was a pre-title.
I'm sorry, Joan Steidinger, we just lost you for a second there. Okay, we're going to try calling Joan back. Looks like we've lost her. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Joan Steidinger. She is a sports psychologist and author of the a book entitled Sisterhood in Sports, How Female Athletes Collaborate and Compete. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Have you been a female on a predominantly male team? Well, what was your experience? You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Joan Steidinger, you're back?
Yes, I'm
okay.
Right here.
Great. Okay.
Okay.
Technology. Well, and when they're talking, they're not necessarily just talking about how they're going to win the race, but they're talking about other stuff. They're just talking.
Yeah, personal stuff too.
And you're saying that females tend to then take, when they're on a predominantly male team, they'll take their cue from the males on the team.
Yeah, I think that happens more often than not.
Do you have any sense about whether this increasing trend, now it's still very spotty. I think there's only 8 or maybe 10 girls in the entire state of Ohio that play on a high school hockey team, a male team. But do you have any sense about whether the females change the dynamics when they are on a team of primarily men?
I have more of a sense that the females
are
kind
changed.
Are part of the dynamic of the men, as opposed to them changing the dynamic.
They adapt.
And I think the more we can get women and young women into these teams, the more there'll be a female presence. But I think there's also a very powerful masculine push to do it the way the boys want to. It happens in sports. It happens, you know, in work. It happens anywhere where there's predominantly males in a situation, particularly in a team situation. Because it's more hierarchical with men, where girls tend to be, like I said previously, more collaborative.
Does that bring out the best, or does it change how the female athlete performs at all? Do you have a sense about that?
No, I don't think it affects performance, because obviously if they're that good, they've been playing with men a long time, so they're used to it. And they just are more focused on their performance and making sure they can be, I can't say more, but they can be more focused on their performance than necessarily on the dynamics of the situation, other than them just not talking as much, for one thing.
Let's take a call from Mark in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Mark.
How are you?
Good.
Yeah, I think what Joan's talking about, from what I've studied, it's based in anthropology and genetics, going back 10,000 plus years when the tribe existed. And you had the men go out on a hunting party, they would be silent. They wouldn't be chatty. If they're chatty, the game found them. Or the ones who were silent would get rid of the chatty person because they would scare away the game. That's also why men like colors like brown, blue, gray, and the distant colors you see if you're sitting behind a rock and looking across the savannah. And you do all that in silence. So men live their lives inside of themselves. Now the women live their lives on the outside of themselves. So going back to that same tribe, when the women went out, they went out as a group. And they'll go out to gather these seeds and berries. They had to know minutiae from day to day what the color of the seeds and the berries were. Because one day they'd be good to eat, the next day they would not be good to eat. Also,
so they
at the
had
same
to talk
time,
to survive, yeah.
Yeah, they had to communicate with each other because they're smaller. They weren't as muscular to fight off maybe a lion as the men would. So they do it as a group. So they keep in touch with each other. Also, they'd be carrying a child on their back, and then maybe a third or fourth thing. So that's why women can do three, four, five things at the same time.
Because that's how they
men
started.
Men can only do one well. Hmm.
Well, Joan, thank you, Mark. Joan Steidinger, what do you make of Mark's analysis there?
Well, I think he's right in the sense of the gathering versus the hunting is a good analogy. I will say, though, that women are a lot stronger than they are given credit for. There's a quote in an article from a while ago about women in sports that says, anatomy is not destiny, and gender is not a determinant of ability. So that women may not have as big of muscles, but many women can be just as strong. I mean, it's evident when you look at endurance events.
Mm-hmm.
You will see a greater percentage of women finish the event and now are outright winning some of these events as they're getting more confidence and not holding back as much as they used to. And I think that's the big thing. Women aren't taught to take risks as much. Particularly muscular women. I think that was one of the things that we had talked about. You know, the judgment in our culture is that skinny women, blonde women are the ultimate in terms of athletes.
Mm.
When in fact, all these, they body shame these big, strong girls like Serena Williams and a woman named Jessica Ennis Hill. And in fact, Jessica Ennis Hill, who was a pentathlete, heptathlete, in the who's from England, had one of the Olympic officials blurt out that she was fat, and she had not an ounce of fat on her. She was muscled. She mm-hmm. was strong, and she went on and won the gold medal. And this is the 2012 Olympics, I believe, mm-hmm. and then the last Olympics, she won a silver medal. So there's nothing fat about her. It's just her body type is different.
But we
and I think
stereotype women.
Yes.
And what they're supposed to
we
look
don't.
Like.
Yeah, we, you know, it's like, who's a great athlete? For years, up until last year, excuse me, up until last year, when you looked on the internet, who are the 10 best women in sport? It had nothing to do with their abilities. It was always the 10 best-looking women in sport.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I put in who are the 10 best-performing women in sport, it still do the list in terms of looks. Now, last year on the internet, there was a change. And they actually have lists now of the 10 best-performing women in sport. They're just kind of few and far between, but they are lists that actually look at people's women's accomplishments in sport and rank them in that way. You know, there's a reason that Serena Williams is the only woman in the list of the women's world's top 10 earning athletes. She's the only female in that list. Hmm. So the inequality is just huge.
Right. We are going to take a break. Joan Steidinger is a sports psychologist and author of Sisterhood in Sports, How Female Athletes Collaborate and Compete. She's going to stay with us, and we're going to hear from a local athlete who plays on a boys' high school hockey team. So stay with us. We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. We want to hear from women who have played in competitive sports and what their experience has been. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Before Title IX was enacted almost 50 years ago, roughly 300,000 girls participated in high school sports. By 2010, that number had mushroomed to 3 million. Still, when it comes to traditionally male-dominated sports such as wrestling, and football, and ice hockey, for many girls the only option is to make the boys' team. Still with us by phone is sports psychologist and author of the 2014 book, Sisterhood in Sports, How Female Athletes Collaborate and Compete, Joan Steidinger. Thomas Worthington High School senior Charlotte Klein is the sole female member of Thomas's varsity hockey team, and she joins us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also with us, Thomas Worthington High School hockey coach Bill McGill. Thanks for joining us as well.
Great to be here.
Bill, you know, Charlotte's not the first girl to play on a Thomas team. I think she's the second, maybe.
The second, yes.
How does that work as a coach? How do you make that work?
Well, there's some you know, obvious challenges.
Logistical challenges,
separate locker rooms. But for the most part, she fits right in and her predecessor had fit right in. It's, you know, I think everyone's very comfortable with it. You know, very easy to coach. You know, I think that we bring a certain maturity in a teenage female athlete that maybe some of the boys don't have quite yet. So in that respect, it's easier. So.
Charlotte, what about you when you contemplated this? You'd been playing with teams moving up.
Yeah.
Kaha, that kind of a thing.
I'm actually from Wisconsin.
Oh, okay. All right. And did you have girls' teams there?
Yes. Yeah, right. I played on an all-girls high school team before this.
So what was the difference between the all-girls team and then coming and playing on a boys' team?
I think it's a new challenge. It's been a lot of fun, and the boys kind of treat me just like one of the guys, and it's been a lot of fun.
Joan Steidinger, a psychologist, and as we mentioned, author, mentioned earlier that when girls play on male-dominated teams like you are, they tend to take their cues from the males then. So if they're in a talking mood, you'll talk. But if they're feeling reticent and are inside their heads, you'll step back. Do you relate to that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. But I also, like, as a senior, I feel like I also talk a lot, too, in the locker
room. You feel
more
comfortable?
Yeah.
Have you been on the team since you were a freshman?
I'm at my old high school, I was.
Yeah. Did you notice the team interaction was different when it was all girls versus all mostly boys and one girl?
Yes. I think on the girls' team, we were a lot more emotional. We talk, like, more about emotions. And the guys, it's different.
you know, Joe Steidinger, this is you're hearing this. It sounds familiar, right? Joan Steidinger?
Yep.
Oh, okay. You're hearing Charlotte talk?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, so she's Hello? Saying, yeah, the girls talk more. They talk about their emotions more.
Oh, absolutely. There's a study that was done years ago in 2000 about entitled Tend and Befriend, and a woman looked at, there'd never been a stress study on women, so she took all these old stress studies and pulled out the women and found that women in times of challenge, they don't fight or flight, they tend to be emotional and flock to either their girlfriends or friends and talk about their feelings and also protect their children. But there's a much more emotional response to stress from women than from men.
And Bill McGill, as a coach, do you like that emotional response? I mean, would you like to see more emotion from your players?
You know, I don't see that much of it, to be honest with you. You know, I think the emotion maybe is when you're with a group of girls together, maybe it's more emotional. I've also coached girls soccer a little bit, so I see the difference between the boys and the girls. To me, when I see Charlotte, she's very even-keeled and, again, being a senior, more mature than a lot of the guys on the team. So it's
a little apples and oranges then.
Yeah.
So. Let's turn to some callers real quick. Chris in Iowa, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I played sports when I was over 50, so it was kind of in the early stages of that. It was basketball for women was a bigger deal than the basketball for men in Iowa for the tournaments and so forth, but it was a different game.
Yeah,
the rules were different, and it played to the women's strengths. And I think looking at what we bring to the table, it was more of a mental game, but still different, but still exciting. So maybe not trying to have everyone play the exact same roles, the exact same game. Everybody has something to bring to the table. And I would like to hear what people have to say about the influence of coaching into this, because still dominated with men coaches, when women come into the game, they bring a different aspect to the game as well. I had only sons, and I was not encouraged to coach. I coached one time out of probably 25 different teams, and it was interesting, but not encouraged.
Even though you had that much of a background in the sport, you were not encouraged to coach?
Absolutely not, and I had played many, many more years than my husband did. And with no experience at all, he was encouraged to coach.
Charlotte, when you were on a team in Wisconsin, an all-girl mm-hmm. team, did you have a male or female coaches or both?
We had both. So we had our head coach was a male, but we had some female assistant coaches.
And did you notice any difference? I mean, it's certainly not a study, but do you have an impression?
I think that the female coaches were able to, like, relate more, like, emotionally to the girls on the team. But I think, like, overall, like, it's pretty good either way.
Yeah. What about that, Joan Steidinger?
Well, it's a whole interesting issue. I'm writing a new book called Stand Up and Shout Out, Women in Sport Demand Equality.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to be writing the coaches chapter. And the female coaches tend to be expected to be as good as the best male coach. And yet they're not treated as well as the best male coach. But one of the things, I interviewed Lindsay Gottlieb, who's the coach of UC Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
for my first book, the book Sisterhood book. And she said what she does is she goes, takes time at the beginning of the season to have like a half hour with each girl, get to know her as a person besides a player, and then reassure her that if they're not playing at a certain time, it's nothing personal, it's business. And then she tries to be sensitive to things when things happen to the females. So she's a lot more tuned in to the emotional state, I think, of women. And one of the travesties we have in this country is that women coaches are still, when girls' sports first came into being, with Title IX, 93% of the women's games were coached by females. And now, at this point, only 41.5% of the teams are coached by female coaches.
Is that a kind of a relationship between the popularity of the game and as it's attracted more money and more viewership, it becomes more enticing to men?
Well, no, it's just as enticing to women.
Yeah, just as enticing to women, but more men want to do it, and now they're competing more.
No, more men don't want to do it.
Okay.
Just as many women want to do
it. Well, what do you make of that, then?
Well, most of the hiring staff, particularly in the NCAA across the country, are white males.
Gotcha.
So white males like to hire other white males or people that look and think like them. And so we have a terrible problem in this country giving very capable women opportunities to coach across the board.
I want to say thanks to Chris in Iowa for that call. We appreciate it. And now Nancy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I've been on your program before for ADHD, and I thought of three things. One, I was training for the Boston Marathon, and I couldn't find anyone to train with me because I was so talkative. But I found a man with ADHD. So I thought, oh my God, this is great! And it was an 18-mile training thing up Heartbreak Hill, and I talked and I talked, and I made him so mad. Every single time I got up next to him, he would put his arm up and, like, you know, pushed me away with the air. And I thought, well, this is no fun, you know, because I thought he had ADD and he would talk with me. That was one thing. The other comment is, I just thought of this, is women in, you know, locker rooms and hot tubs. And my former husband and I used to go to Canyon Ranch each year. And, you know, and afterwards you'd exercise and go into the hot tub in the mm-hmm. locker room. And at dinner, I would come with all these stories. Oh, my God, I met this woman. Blah, 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 blah. And he looked at me once and he said, this is so weird. He said, men don't say a thing in the hot. He said, especially in the hot tub. So right. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
And then following up on the comment about when the earlier man said something about cultural and tribal stuff.
Yeah.
When I was 11 to 12 years old, until we got evacuated, we lived in Uganda during Idi Amin's regime. And the high school that I was in, Lincoln High School, you know, people were being evacuated and the high school shrunk. And we had a basketball team and there weren't enough boys to be on it. And I was the biggest girl, so they chose me to be on it. And when it came time for us to play one of the local teams, you know, an all-African team, we went to play the first game, and a surprising thing happened. Every time I got the ball and went down the court, the other players on the opposing team would just scatter.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm glad you brought that up. I'm glad you brought that up, Nancy, because I'm wondering, Charlotte, do you feel like, you hear police officers say that when they're out in their own car and dressed as civilians, people are racing all over the place speeding, but when they're in their cruiser, you know, everybody slows down. Do you feel like it affects the behavior of the other players on the other teams?
Yeah, I think most of the time everyone on the other team is, like, good with me out there, and it's pretty good, but every couple games there's usually a player or two on the other team who's not happy about it, and I get targeted or stuff like
that. Either you're targeted or... And Bill, what do you do with that?
Well, it rallies our team a little bit. Okay. Our team does rally behind Charlotte, and, you know, of course I'm talking to the referees about it, but, you know, it isn't every game, but it does happen every three or four games. You have one or two players on the other team that just think, she doesn't belong out here. We're going to take advantage of this. And Charlotte deals with it very well, and I think we deal with it as a team pretty well.
Real quick, I want to talk to Monica in Columbus. We only have about 30 seconds, Monica, but I wanted to squeeze you in.
Oh, yeah. Well, congratulations to Charlotte for doing what she does. My daughter's actually playing for Upper Arlington High School. She's a freshman, and she's on the JV team. So,
okay.
Her goal is to make varsity, and yeah, it's a question too. I had it. Does she feel like she gets targeted? And obviously, you just answered that. And
okay.
And my daughter Kyle does once in a while, but the boys are excellent with her, and they treat her as a hockey player.
All right. Well, Monica, thank you. Thanks a lot for that call. Having Charlotte on the team is good for the team, Bill.
Very much so. She's intelligent. She's a leader. She's just a great person to have around.
Well, Bill McGill, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Bill McGill, hockey coach at Thomas Worthington High School. Also, Charlotte Klein. She's the only female athlete on the Thomas Worthington High School's varsity hockey team. And you were the only senior on senior night to get a goal, I just
yes.
heard, right? Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. And Joan Steidinger, sports psychologist and author of Sisterhood in Sports, How Female Athletes Collaborate and Compete. Thanks for your help today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's it. I appreciate everybody calling in, and I appreciate you listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.